my curiosity. "It's a matter of some urgency," said Maya. "Luke Garraway, our pack's leader." Preeter Scott gave her a sharp look, silencing her. Though he might have been packless, he was an alpha. That much was clear from his bearing. His eyes, under his thick eyebrows, were green-gray. Around his throat, under the collar of his shirt, sparkled the bronze pendant of the preacher with its imprint of a wolf's paw. "The preacher chooses what matters it will regard as urgent," he said. "Nor are we a hotel open to uninvited guests. Jordan took a chance in bringing you here, and he knows that. If he were not one of our most promising graduates, I might well send you both away." Jordan hooked his thumbs into the waistband of his jeans and looked at the ground. A moment later, Preeter Scott set his hand on Jordan's shoulder. "But," he said, "you are one of our most promising graduates, and you look exhausted. I can see you were up all night. Come, and we'll discuss this in my office." The office turned out to be down a long and winding hallway, elegantly paneled in dark wood. The house was lively with the sound of voices, and a sign saying, "House Rules," was pinned to the wall beside a staircase leading up. "House Rules. No shape-shifting in the hallways. No howling. No silver. Clothes must be worn at all times. All times. No fighting. No biting. Mark all your food before you put it in the communal refrigerator." The smell of cooking breakfast wafted through the air, making Maya's stomach grumble. Preacher Scott sounded amused. "I'll have someone make us up a plate of snacks if you're hungry." "Thanks," Maya muttered. They had reached the end of the hallway, and Preacher Scott opened a door marked "Office." The older werewolf's eyebrows drew together. "Rufus," he said, "what are you doing here?" Maya peered past him. The office was a large room, comfortably messy. There was a rectangular picture window that gave out onto wide lawns, on which groups of mostly young people were executing what looked like drill maneuvers, wearing black warm-up pants and tops. The walls of the room were lined with books about lycanthropy, many in Latin, but Maya recognized the word lupus. The desk was a slab of marble set upon the statues of two snarling wolves. In front of it were two chairs. In one of them sat a large man, a werewolf, hunched over, his hands gripped together.
"Preacher," he said in a grating voice, "I had hoped to speak with you regarding the incident in Boston."
"The one in which you broke your assigned charge's leg?" the preacher said dryly. "I will be speaking to you about it, Rufus, but not this moment. Something more pressing calls me."
"That preacher."
"That will be all, Rufus," said Scott, in the ringing tone of an alpha wolf whose orders were not to be challenged. "Remember, this is a place of rehabilitation. Part of that is learning to respect authority." Muttering under his breath, Rufus rose from the chair. Only when he stood up did Maya realize and react to his enormous size. He towered over both her and Jordan, his black t-shirt straining over his chest, the sleeves about to split around his biceps. His head was closely shaved, his face scored with deep claw marks all across one cheek, like furrows dug in soil. He gave her a sour look as he stalked past them and out into the hall.
"Of course, some of us," Jordan muttered, "are easier to rehabilitate than others."
As Rufus's heavy tread faded down the hall, Scott threw himself into the high-backed chair behind the desk and buzzed a joltingly modern-looking intercom. After requesting breakfast in a terse voice, he leaned back, hands clasped behind his head.
"I'm all ears," he said.
As Jordan recounted their story and their request to Preeter Scott, Maya couldn't keep her eyes and mind from wandering. She wondered what it would have been like to have been raised here, in this elegant house of rules and regulations, rather than with the comparatively lawless freedom of the pack. At some point, a werewolf dressed all in black it seemed to be the regulation outfit of the praetor, came in with sliced roast beef, cheese, and protein drinks on a pewter tray. Maya eyed the breakfast with some dismay. It was true that werewolves needed more protein than normal people, much more. But roast beef for breakfast? You'll find, Praetor Scott said as Maya drank her protein shake gingerly, that, in fact, refined sugar is harmful to werewolves. If you cease consuming it for a period of time, you will cease desiring it. Hasn't your pack leader told you that? Maya tried to imagine Luke, who liked to make pancakes in odd and amusing shapes, lecturing her about sugar, and failed. Now was not the time to mention that, though. No, he has, of course, she said. I tend to, backslide in times of stress. I understand your concern for your pack leader, said Scott. A gold Rolex glinted on his wrist. Normally, we maintain a strict policy of non-interference regarding matters not related to new-fledged downworlders. We do not, in fact, prioritize werewolves over other downworlders, though only lycanthropes are allowed into the praetor. But that's exactly why we do need your help, said Jordan. Packs are by their nature always moving, transitional. They have no opportunity to build up things like libraries of stored knowledge. I'm not saying they don't have wisdom, but everything is an oral tradition, and every pack knows different things. We could go from pack to pack, and maybe someone would know how to cure Luke. But we don't have time. Here, he gestured at the books lining the walls, is the closest thing werewolves have to, say, the archives of the Silent Brothers, or the spiral labyrinth of the Warlocks. Scott looked unconvinced. Maya set her protein shake down. And Luke isn't just any pack leader, she said. He's the lycanthrope's representative on the council. If you help cure him, you would know that the praetor would always have a council voice in their favor. Scott's eyes glinted. Interesting, he said. Very well. I'll have a look through the books. It'll probably take a few hours. Jordan, I suggest that if you're going to drive back to Manhattan, you get some rest. We don't need you wrapping your truck around a tree. I could drive, Maya began. You look equally exhausted. Jordan, as you know, there will always be a room for you here at the Praetor House, even though you've graduated. And Nick is on assignment, so there's a bed for Maya. Why don't you both get some rest, and I'll call you down when I'm finished. He swiveled around in his chair to examine the books on the walls. Jordan gestured to Maya that this was their cue to leave. She stood up, brushing crumbs off her jeans. She was halfway to the door when Praetor Scott spoke again. Oh, and Maya Roberts, he said, and his voice held a note of warning. I hope you understand that when you make a promise in other people's names, it falls upon your head to make sure they follow through. Simon awoke, still feeling exhausted, blinking in the darkness. The thick black curtains over the windows let in very little light, but his internal body clock told him it was daytime. That, and the fact that Isabel was gone, her side of the bed rumpled, the covers turned back. Daytime, and he hadn't talked to Clary since she'd gone. He drew his hand out from under the covers and looked at the gold ring on his right hand. Delicate. It was etched with what were either designs or words in an alphabet he didn't know. Clenching his jaw, he sat up and touched the ring. Clary? The answer was immediate and clear. He nearly slid off the bed with relief. Simon, thank God. Can you talk? No. He felt, rather than heard, a tense distraction in the voice of her mind. I'm glad you spoke to me. But now isn't good. I'm not alone. But you're all right. I'm fine. Nothing's happened yet. I'm trying to gather information. I promise I'll talk to you the moment I hear anything. Okay, take care of yourself. You too. And she was gone. Sliding his legs over the side of the mattress, Simon did his best to flatten his sleep-mussed hair and went to see if anyone else was awake. They were. Alec, Magnus, Jocelyn, and Isabel sat around the table in Magnus's living room. While Alec and Magnus were in jeans, both Jocelyn and Isabel wore gear, Isabel with her whip wrapped around her right arm. She glanced up as he came in, but didn't smile. Her shoulders were tense, her mouth a thin line. They all had mugs of coffee in front of them. There's a reason the ritual of the mortal instruments was so complicated. Magnus made the sugar bowl float over to himself and dumped some of the white powder into his coffee. Angels act at the behest of God, not human beings, not even shadow hunters. Summon one, and you're likely to find yourself blasted with divine wrath. The whole point of the mortal instruments ritual wasn't that it allowed someone to summon Raziel. It was that it protected the summoner from the angel's wrath once he did appear. Valentine, Alec began. Yes, Valentine also summoned a very minor angel, and it never spoke to him, did it? Never gave him a sliver of help, though he harvested its blood. And even then, he must have been using incredibly powerful spells just to bind it. My understanding is that he tied its life to the Wayland Manor, so that when the angel died, the manor collapsed to rubble. He tapped a blue painted fingernail on his mug. And he damned himself. Whether you believe in heaven and hell or not, he damned himself, surely. When he summoned Raziel, Raziel struck him down, partly in revenge for what Valentine had done to his brother Angel.
Why are we talking about summoning angels? Simon asked, perching himself on the end of the long table.
Isabel and Jocelyn went to see the Iron Sisters, said Alec, looking for a weapon that could be used on Sebastian that wouldn't affect Jace.
And there isn't one?
Nothing in this world, said Isabel. A heavenly weapon might do it, or something with a seriously demonic alliance. We were exploring the first option.
Summoning up an angel to give you a weapon?
It's happened before, said Magnus. Raziel gave the mortal sword to Jonathan Shadowhunter. In the old stories, the night before the Battle of Jericho, an angel appeared and gave Joshua a sword.
Huh, said Simon. I would have thought angels would have been all about peace, not weapons.
Magnus snorted. Angels are not just messengers. They are soldiers. Michael is said to have routed armies. They are not patient, angels. Certainly not with the vicissitudes of human beings. Anyone who tried to summon Raziel without the mortal instruments to protect them would probably be blasted to death on the spot. Demons are easier to summon. There are more of them, and many are weak. But then, a weak demon can help you only so much.
We can't summon a demon, said Jocelyn aghast. The Clave...
I thought you stopped caring what the Clave thought of you years ago, Magnus said.
It's not just me, said Jocelyn. The rest of you, Luke, my daughter.
If the Clave knew...
Well, they won't know, will they? Said Alec,
his usually gentle voice edged.
Unless you tell them.
Jocelyn looked from Isabel's still face to Magnus's inquiring one, to Alec's stubborn blue eyes.
You're really considering this? Summoning a demon?
Well, not just any demon, said Magnus.
Azazel.
Jocelyn's eyes blazed.
Azazel?
Her eyes scanned the others, as if looking for support. But Izzy and Alec glanced down at their mugs, and Simon just shrugged.
I don't know who Azazel is, he said.
Isn't he the cat from the Smurfs? He cast about. But Isabel just looked up and rolled her eyes at him.
Clary, he thought.
Her voice came through, tinged with alarm.
What is it? What's happened? Did my mom find out I'm gone?
Not yet, he thought back.
Is Azazel the cat from the Smurfs?
There was a long pause.
That's Azrael, Simon, and no more using the magic rings for Smurf questions.
And she was gone.
Simon glanced up from his hand and saw Magnus looking at him quizzically.
He's not a cat, Sylvester, he said. He's a greater demon. Lieutenant of Hell and Forger of Weapons. He was an angel who taught mankind how to make weapons, when before it had been knowledge only angels possessed. That caused him to fall, and now he is a demon. And the whole earth has been corrupted by the works that were taught by Azazel. To him ascribe all sin. Alec looked at Magnus in amazement. How do you know all that?
He's a friend of mine, said Magnus, and noting their expressions, sighed.
Okay, not really, but it is in the Book of Enoch.
Seems dangerous, Alec frowned. It sounds like he's beyond a greater demon, even. Like Lilith.
Fortunately, he is already bound, said Magnus. If you summon him, his spirit form will come to you, but his corporeal self will remain bound to the jagged rocks of Duduel.
The jagged rocks of... Oh, whatever, Isabel said, winding her long dark hair into a bun.
He's a demon of weapons. Fine. I say we give it a go.
I can't believe you're even considering this, said Jocelyn. I learned from watching my husband what dabbling in raising demons can do.
Clary, she broke off then, as if sensing Simon's gaze on her, and turned.
Simon, she said, do you know, is Clary awake yet? We've been letting her sleep, but it's almost 11.
Simon hesitated.
I don't know.
This, he reasoned, was true. Wherever Clary was, she could be sleeping. Even though he had just talked to her.
Jocelyn looked puzzled. But weren't you in the room with her?
No, I wasn't. I was...
Simon broke off, realizing the hole he'd just dug himself. There were three spare bedrooms. Jocelyn had been in one, Clary the other. Which would obviously mean he must have slept in the third room with...
Isabel? Said Alec, his eyebrows raised.
You slept in Isabel's room?
Isabel waved a hand. No need to worry, big brother. Nothing happened.
Of course, she added as Alec's shoulders relaxed, I was totally passed out drunk, so he could really have done whatever he wanted to me and I wouldn't have woken up.
Oh, please, said Simon. All I did was tell you the entire plot of Star Wars.
I don't think I remember that, said Isabel. Taking a cookie from the plate on the table.
Oh, yeah?
Who was Luke Skywalker's best childhood friend?
Biggs Darklighter, Isabel said immediately, and then hit the table with the flat of her hand.
That is so cheating!
Still, she grinned at him around her cookie.
Ah, Magnus said, nerd love. It is a beautiful thing, while also being an object of mockery and hilarity for those of us who are more sophisticated.
All right, that's enough. Jocelyn stood up. I'm going to get Clary. If you're going to raise a demon, I don't want to be here. And I don't want my daughter to be here either. She headed toward the hallway.
Simon blocked her way.
You can't do that, he said.
Jocelyn looked at him with a set face.
I know you're going to say that this is the safest place for us, Simon. But with a demon being raised, I just...
It's not that. Simon took a deep breath, which didn't help since his blood no longer processed oxygen. He felt slightly sick.
You can't go wake her up because...
Because she isn't here.
Chapter 10 The Wild Hunt. Jordan's old room at the Preter house looked like any dormitory room at any college. There were two iron-framed beds, each set against a different wall. Through the window separating them, green lawns were visible 3 floors down. Jordan's side of the room was fairly bare. It looked as if he had taken most of his photographs and books with him to Manhattan, though there were some tacked-up pictures of beaches and the ocean, and a surfboard leaning against one wall. A little jolt went through Maya as she saw that on the bedside table was a gold-framed photo of her with Jordan, taken at Ocean City, the boardwalk and the beach behind them. Jordan looked at the photograph and then at her. He blushed. He slung his bag onto his bed and stripped off his jacket, his back to her.
When will your roommate be back? She asked into the suddenly uncomfortable silence. She wasn't sure why they were both embarrassed. They certainly hadn't been when they'd been in the truck together. But now, here in Jordan's space, the years they'd spent not speaking seemed to press them apart. Who knows? Nick's on assignment. They're dangerous. He might not come back. Jordan sounded resigned. He tossed his jacket over the back of a chair. Why don't you lie down? I'm going to take a shower. He headed for the bathroom, which, Maya was relieved to see, was attached to his room. She didn't feel like dealing with one of those shared bathroom down the hall things. Jordan, she began, but he'd already closed the bathroom door behind him. She could hear water running. With a sigh, she kicked off her shoes and lay down on the absent Nick's bed. The blanket was dark blue plaid and smelled like pine cones. She looked up and saw that the ceiling was wallpapered with photographs. The same laughing blonde boy, who looked about 17, smiled down at her out of each picture. Nick, she guessed. He looked happy. Had Jordan been happy? Here at the Preter house? She reached out and flipped the photograph of the two of them toward her. It had been taken years ago, when Jordan was skinny, with big hazel eyes that dominated his face. They had their arms around each other and looked sunburned and happy. Summer had darkened both their skins and put light streaks in Maya's hair, and Jordan had his head turned slightly toward her, as if he were going to say something or kiss her. She couldn't remember which. Not anymore. She thought of the boy whose bed she was sitting on, the boy who might never come back. She thought of Luke, slowly dying, and of Alaric, and Gretel, and Justine, and Theo, and all the others of her pack who had lost their lives in the war against Valentine. She thought of Max, and of Jace, two Lightwoods lost, for she had to admit in her heart she didn't think they would ever get Jace back. And lastly, and strangely, she thought of Daniel, the brother she had never mourned for. And to her surprise, she felt tears sting the back of her eyes. She sat up abruptly. She felt as if the world were tilting and she was clinging on helplessly, trying to keep from tumbling into a black abyss. She could feel the shadows closing in. With Jace lost and Sebastian out there, things could only get darker. There would only be more loss and more death. She had to admit, the most alive she'd felt in weeks had been those moments at dawn, kissing Jordan in his car. As if she were in a dream, she found herself getting to her feet. She walked across the room and opened the door to the bathroom. The shower was a square of frosted glass. She could see Jordan's silhouette through it. She doubted he could hear her over the running water as she pulled off her sweater and shimmied out of her jeans and underwear. With a deep breath, she crossed the room, slid the shower door open, and stepped inside. Jordan spun around, pushing the wet hair out of his eyes. The shower was running hot, and his face was flushed, making his eyes shine as if the water had polished them. Or maybe it wasn't just the water making the blood rise under his skin as his eyes took her in. All of her. She looked back at him, steadily, not embarrassed, watching the way the Preter Lupus pendant shone in the wet hollow of his throat, and the slide of the soap suds over his shoulders and chest as he stared at her, blinking water out of his eyes. He was beautiful. But then, she had always thought so. Maya, he said unsteadily, are you... Shh. She put her fingers against his lips, drawing the shower door closed with her other hand. Then she stepped closer, wrapping both arms around him, letting the water wash both of them clean of the darkness. Don't talk. Just kiss me. So he did. What in the name of the angel do you mean Clary isn't there? Jocelyn demanded, white-faced. How do you know that if you just woke up? Where is she gone? Simon swallowed. He'd grown up with Jocelyn as almost a second mother to him. He was used to her protectiveness of her daughter. But she had always seen him as an ally in that, someone who would stand between Clary and the dangers of the world. Now she was looking at him like the enemy. "She texted me last night," Simon began, then stopped as Magnus waved him over to the table. "You might as well sit down," he said. Isabel and Alec were watching wide-eyed from either side of Magnus, but the warlock didn't look particularly surprised. "Tell us all what's going on. I have a feeling this is going to take a while." It did, though not as long as Simon might have hoped. When he was done explaining, hunched over on his chair and staring down at Magnus's scratched table, he lifted his head to see Jocelyn fixing him with a green stare as cold as Arctic water. "You let my daughter go off with Jace? To some unfindable, untraceable place where none of us can reach her?" Simon looked down at his hands. "I can reach her," he said, holding up his right hand with the gold ring on the finger. "I told you. I heard from her this morning. She said she was fine." "You never should have let her leave in the first place!" "I didn't let her. She was going to go anyway. I thought she might as well have some kind of lifeline, since it's not like I could stop her." "To be fair," said Magnus, "I don't think anyone could. Clary does what she wants." He looked at Jocelyn. "You can't keep her in a cage." "I trusted you," she snapped at Magnus. "How did she get out?"
"She made a portal."
"But you said there were wards."
"To keep threats out, not to keep guests in."
"Jocelyn, your daughter isn't stupid, and she does what she thinks is right. You can't stop her. No one can stop her. She is a great deal like her mother." Jocelyn looked at Magnus for a moment, her mouth slightly open. And Simon realized that, of course, Magnus must have known Clary's mother when she was young, when she betrayed Valentine and the Circle and nearly died in the uprising. "She's a little girl," she said, and turned to Simon. "You've spoken to her? Using these rings? Since she left?"
"This morning," said Simon. "She said she was fine, that everything was fine."
Instead of seeming reassured, Jocelyn only looked angrier.
"I'm sure that's what she said, Simon.
I can't believe you allowed her to do this. You should have restrained her."
"What, tied her up?" Simon said in disbelief. "Handcuffed her to the dinner table?
If that's what it took, you're stronger than she is. I'm disappointed in..."
Isabel stood up.
"Okay, that's enough." She glared at Jocelyn. "It is totally and completely unfair to yell at Simon over something Clary decided to do on her own. And if Simon had tied her up for you, then what? Were you planning on keeping her tied up forever? You'd have to let her go eventually. And then what? She wouldn't trust Simon anymore, and she already doesn't trust you because you stole her memories. And that, if I recall, was because you were trying to protect her. Maybe if you hadn't protected her so much, she would know more about what is dangerous and what isn't, and be a little less secretive and less reckless."
Everyone stared at Isabel. And for a moment, Simon was reminded of something that Clary had said to him once, that Izzy rarely made speeches, but when she did, she made them count. Jocelyn was white around the lips.
"I'm going to the station to be with Luke," she said. "Simon, I expect reports from you every 24 hours that my daughter is all right."
"If I don't hear from you every night, I'm going to the Clave." And she stalked out of the apartment, slamming the door behind her so hard that a long crack appeared in the plaster beside it. Isabel sat back down, this time beside Simon. He said nothing to her, but held out his hand, and she took it, slipping her fingers between his.
"So," Magnus said finally, breaking the silence, "who's up for raising Azazel? Because we're going to need a whole lot of candles." Jason Clary spent the day wandering through maze-like tiny streets that ran along canals whose water ranged from deep green to murky blue. They made their way among the tourists in St. Mark's Square and over the Bridge of Sighs and drank small, powerful cups of espresso at Café Florian. The disorienting maze of streets reminded Clary a bit of Alicante,
though Alicante lacked Venice's feeling of elegant decay. There were no roads